How do I avoid suffering? What's actually wrong with this world? And what the heck can I do to fix it? That's what we're talking about today on the Conscious Success Podcast, where we teach you how to master your mind, expand your wealth, and enhance your health. I'm your host, Madhu, and I'm joined today by one of my favorite humans in the world because he is someone who's been a teacher for me for about 15 years. His name is Hridayananda Das Goswami, aka Dr. Howard Resnick. And I have to list off some of this incredible human's qualifications and accomplishments, just so you have an idea of who you get the fortune of listening to today. Not only has he been a monk for over 50 years and a guru to many tens of thousands of individuals around the world, but he has a PhD in Sanskrit and Indian studies. He's lectured in universities worldwide, from UCLA to University of Florida and beyond. He is one of the most senior disciples of A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada since 1969. If you're not familiar with who that is, go check that out. And one of the most influential people, frankly, in history. He's established over 20 centers around the globe. He's fluent in over 7 languages, amongst one of the first Western Sanskrit scholars in translating Sanskrit literatures worldwide. I mean, frankly, just one of the most well-respected spiritual leaders on the planet today. He's known for his scholarship. He's relatable. He's hilarious, as well as humble. And among my favorite is he can bridge super lofty, deep topics and explain them in very accessible and practical and palatable ways. You are in for a treat. Check this out. You were living as a monk for over 22 years when you decided to go get your PhD in Harvard. Is that right?
Well, it was 1991. First, I decided to finish up my bachelor's degree, which I'd abandoned to take up the monastic lifestyle. So I was living in LA, so I just went to UCLA and finished up in world religions. And then Harvard actually invited me to apply because I had a track record of having translated a lot of books in Sanskrit, and I applied to the Department of Sanskrit and Indian Studies. And so they actually allowed me just to skip the master's degree and go straight from a bachelor's degree to a PhD program.
Because you just had so much experience in translating
because I published many books, translations. So they were very nice. Harvard was very, very kind to me. And they invited me to apply. And then they just put me right in the PhD program.
It makes sense. So you're perfect combination of like scholarly in world religions and familiar. Right. You might not admit it, but everyone who knows you, we know you.
That was my undergraduate degree in world religions.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason I went to Harvard, because I think you know, we touched on that, is, and I wrote this in my application to Harvard, which they appreciated, is that I told them that I'd been so many years, like you said, 22 years, sort of in this somewhat sequestered lifestyle. I wasn't a monk hidden away from the world. I was lecturing around the world, but still, you know, the world was just a place to be saved and educated about spiritual things. It wasn't, you know, a world to really be taken that seriously because it was the fallen world, and which is typical of monastic worldviews. So I realized at a certain point that the way I put it in my my essay to Harvard is I felt I had become, or I was in danger of becoming, intellectually incestuous. Intellectually incestuous, because I was just in this community when we were all talking. Sounds like America now, right? The political discourse, which is also incestuous now, you know, and incest doesn't produce healthy results. So I realized I didn't really understand the world I was trying to save. And so I felt a need to go back to the world and just not to be of the world, but in the world, and just try to understand intellectually, culturally, what was the world? Because after 22 years, as we know, because of technology, history has dramatically accelerated. It goes much faster than it used to. So things that used to take a century now, you know, maybe it's like 5 years or something. And so I wanted to understand the world. And I felt that I was at a point where I didn't need all these, let's say, the super protection of a sequestered life where I was, you know, preaching, as we said, but not really taking the world that seriously, not really engaging with the world. And that's, I also had a realization. It was a dramatic turning point in my life because I realized that I needed to have a conversation with the world and not just talk at them. And also, I think I was intellectually starving because, and interestingly, when I first joined the Hare Krishna movement, I was a student at Berkeley. I actually had a scholarship at Berkeley. I was supposed to be a senior, but I think I'd flunked a few classes, so I technically wasn't a senior because, I mean, we were, you know, I was engaged in all the radical political movements and everything, and, you know, basically even, you know, the students who weren't spiritual, it's like, you know, the professors, the faculty, they were kind of part of the problems. They didn't even show up at our rallies, our political rallies. They didn't want to lose their jobs. They had children to feed and all that. So I wrote to Prabhupada. I wrote him a letter and asked, should I stay in school? And this is very interesting. Prabhupada told me, yeah, you should complete your education, get your degree, because you need that to be able to explain what we're doing to educated people. And so that really, I didn't realize it at the time, but that was become the theme of my life, trying to get a good understanding of history and philosophy and the social sciences, like what planet am I on? And then try to communicate with intelligent people. And I don't just mean technical scholars, but, you know, intelligent people. Try to communicate. And that gets another important point, which I think is absolutely necessary to understand what I understood that I was doing in general. And that is, the understanding was that we lived on a particular planet this time around, which was very fallen, and not just in the sense that everyone's fallen into sin. It's not exactly the Garden of Eden story, but there are parallels. I mean, even the Garden of Eden story apparently came from Babylonian ideas and India. So I think, I'm going to show you now what a nerd I am, but, you know, the two great authors of classical Greece, of course, were Homer and Hesiod. And both of them talk about the world as falling to lower levels. They both talk, this is exactly the same as you find in the Sanskrit literature. There are four ages, like a golden age, and then a silver age, and a bronze age, and this is the iron age. And the age we live in now is the most fallen age. Homer mentions this, and Hesiod also mentions this in ancient Greek literature. And of course, it's really a common understanding in Indo-European culture. And that's a whole other topic, the fact that Sanskrit, the sacred language of South Asia, is in the same language family, I mean, very powerfully in the same language family as all of the European languages, the Slavic, Germanic, Latin languages, even ancient Greek and Albanian. And it's a common understanding that the world moves through cycles. It's not sort of the Middle Eastern linear concept of time. So I and everyone who was doing the same thing I was have had and still have this conviction that the world has become very fallen. Just to give one simple example, kind of going all over the place here. But so that's why I went back to college. Ultimately, everything I was doing, it was meant to be service. And for example, nowadays, everyone talks about rights, human rights. So if you look at the ancient world, they had a very different concept of what it means to be human. Logically, this is not a religious idea. This is just logic, formal logic, that every human right entails, that means logically requires, that someone else have a duty. For example, take the Bill of Rights. If I have a right not to be subjected to unreasonable search and seizure of my property, that means the government has a duty. In fact, everyone in the society has a duty not to do that. So if I have, so every right entails, it means that others have duties. So, for example, you have certain rights, therefore I have certain duties toward you. You know, I have to behave appropriately. I can't deprive you of your property or physically harm you and so on and so forth. So if you look at ancient cultures, they were much more focused on our duties because they understood that if everyone follows their duties, then we will all be able to benefit from the social contract we're engaged in. And all of us will our rights will be protected if we all do our duties. So in the West at the present time and increasingly in the world, people don't talk very much about duties unless everyone likes to talk about other people's duties, like, you know, I have a right to do this and therefore, but what are my duties? And if you say we have rights, I just want one more little point here on this topic. And that is, unlike the present age, there was a time when politicians actually were intelligent. And so an example of that is Thomas Jefferson, flawed as we know, not, you know, up to our standards in some ways, but still brilliant, a very brilliant person. And so in the Declaration of Independence, which he was probably the main author, he said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we're all created equal, endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. If you just take that one declaration, it's full of serious academic philosophy, because a generation before Jefferson, a generation or maybe and a half, there was a Scottish philosopher named David Hume, kind of the bad boy of Scottish philosophy. Anyway, so Hume famously said, it's one of the few things he actually got right, but Hume, although he's considered one of the great philosophers, but that doesn't mean much in the world we live in nowadays, that you, the way he put it, and I'll sort of put it in a little more contemporary language, you can't get an ought from an is, so you know that. So if you say, for example, you have a right, what does it even mean? Because a right is an intangible, non-physical thing. Like, you can't put a right on the table. And so if you say, I have a right, well, why do you have a right? I mean, prove that you have a right. So it's kind of tribal. If everyone in the tribe agrees, that becomes the law of the tribe. But Jefferson, who actually, again, unlike modern leaders, understood philosophy and logic, he realized that a right is a metaphysical object. It's not a physical object like a microphone or a, you know, little carton of coconut water or something. It's not a physical thing. It's metaphysical. It's beyond the physical. And it has to have a metaphysical basis, foundation. There must be some way to demonstrate it metaphysically. And therefore, Jefferson attributed our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He based these rights in another metaphysical fact, namely that the Creator gave them to us. And so nowadays, of course, in secular society, I'm not saying we should have a state church, but they've killed the goose that laid the golden egg, because the goose that laid the golden egg was the Creator. And the idea of separation of church and state, people misunderstand that. If you understand 18th century American history, that simply meant that there's no state church. For America, for the fathers of the revolution, all that, I mean, the world was basically Europe. And that's who they had contact with. So, and if you look at all the writings, the Federalist Papers, they were concerned about Europe. And in Europe, every country had a state church. Church of England, Catholic Church in France, Catholic Church in Spain, and so on and so forth. So what they meant was separation of church and state, no state church. But it was not meant to be a separation of God and country. For example, the Constitutional Convention, as I've read, they sort of hit a deadlock, they hit a wall, and it was really touch and go, like, are we going to really succeed in making a country? That was not at all obvious. In fact, a lot of people thought it won't work. And so at a certain point, they couldn't make any progress, they couldn't agree. So Benjamin Franklin stood up and said, well, the problem is we've forgotten God. So they stopped, had a prayer session, and then they started and it worked. So the idea that you just have a human right, well, I mean, the word human refers to your anatomy. So where in your bodies, in your arms, your legs, your liver, or your brain, where are your rights? So what does it mean to have a human right? In France, sort of, you know, they got inspired by the American Revolution, did one of their own, although it was kind of genocidal. But they have, you know, this Declaration of Human Rights. They don't explain why. And why is a philosophical question. How is just a mechanical question. Like, but why? Why do we have rights? And so people nowadays, I mean, society in general is so superficial, so sort of mindless consumer society that people don't stop to ask, well, what does it mean to say that I possess a metaphysical object like a right? That's a whole philosophical issue. But, and I think I have to also, frankly, I would blame, I think modern academic philosophers really have dropped the ball or, you know, used the ball to, you know, hit innocent people in the face with it, because they've done two things which I think have really degraded society, philosophers, intellectuals, not all of them, but a lot of them, most of the academic philosophers. And the two things they've done which really kind of degraded society, first of all, they became atheists. And atheism is not good philosophy. It's not that, well, if you're honest and if you're really smart and if you read a lot of books, you just, that's the, you know, you inexorably are driven to atheism. Not at all. There's nothing. In fact, atheism is kind of bad philosophy because it doesn't explain anything. And if there's no God, no one knows everything. And if no one knows everything, no one knows that there's a God. And so you could say, well, how do you know there's a God? Well, if there's a God, if there's a God and God is not some weird, I don't know, just some weird, crazy person that creates the world but doesn't want to communicate with anyone. Like it's common to say, well, no one has seen God. Well, how do you know no one's seen God? I mean, even in Christianity, even, you know, in Judaism, in all the religions, well, not all of them, but certainly in the whole panoply of India, they do talk about seeing God. Moses wanted to see God, and he kind of, God moved past him quickly, and he saw, couldn't see all of God. So, but on what grounds will, and if, like, if you haven't seen God, how can you say no one has seen God? It just seems like silliness. So atheism, it's just sort of a dead end. And you get these 20th century philosophers like Sartre and Foucault and Derrida, who really were, in my view, to be honest, terrible philosophers. They contradict themselves constantly, which is bad philosophy. So the philosophers have actually, I think in a real sense, abandoned philosophy. They've done pseudo-philosophy, because if there's no God, then there's no real way to understand the ultimate metaphysical truth, unless there's something that you don't call God, but it's kind of like a God, or we are sort of like God. I mean, how do you, it's really the death of philosophy. Nietzsche understood, actually. I mean, he was apparently an atheist. You know, God is dead and we have killed him, which he meant sort of in a cultural sense. But, and he predicted this is just going to really, you know, the world's going to be a huge mess. So the philosophers, not because there's any good logic for denying God, but just to satisfy their own vanity, you know, this atheist thing. And secondly, they've fallen into the trap of sort of what I would call pseudo-intellectuals, and that is making philosophical language so technical, so even, you know, in their sort of, I would say, ludicrous attempt to be like science. They want to be science-like. They even have equations and symbols. It's kind of embarrassing. You feel sorry for them. And so, therefore, they've taken philosophical discourse and put it on this silly technical platform where 99% of the people in the world have no idea what they're talking about. I believe there's a, he just passed away a couple of years ago, a philosopher, I think from Oxford, named Roger Scruton, made a beautiful, I mean, made these really, really good critiques. Other people, there are other philosophers that I really admire now. Steve, I think his name is Stephen Hicks. He's a Canadian philosopher. So there are some good philosophers, but the idea is that, it's sort of an attack on everything metaphysical. Like, take, for example, modern abstract art. You know, there's the famous story of a properly, intelligently skeptical man in England who just put a canvas on the floor and had his dog walk in paint, then walk on the canvas. And then he presented this as some brilliant new abstract artist. And the whole art world was like gaga over, wow, I think he's trying to say this, right? Or I think she's trying to say that, or I think, and it was just a dog walking on the canvas. So, but anyway, the point is that if everything is art, then nothing is art. If everything is art, nothing is art.
If you've ever considered having a podcast, especially if you're expert at what you do, I cannot suggest more highly using Podigy's service, which is what we use. If you like this production here, I highly suggest you reach out to Podigy through their contact in the show notes below to run and host your podcast. I went through a bunch of different teams, tried a bunch of different things. No one came close to what I got post-production from Podigy, and even just making a launch easy, taking your content, sharing it, making it presentable. Please check out Podigy. If you're great at what you do and you've ever considered having a podcast, I really am excited for you to try them out as well.
Because what does it even mean? Sure, if you say the whole world, you can, you know, you don't have to take LSD. You say everything in the world is in its own way amazing if you understand that. But it's also amazing that someone, a great artist, whether it's a Michelangelo, whoever it is, a Da Vinci, actually has this ability to create great works of art. So it's an attack on civilization. It's an attack. It's sort of this nihilistic attack on culture itself. And so the philosophers really have become useless for people in general. Instead of being lovers of wisdom, they've sort of created their own little meta language. It's like in the Vedas, the caste Brahmins, the bad guys. You know, there were terrible punishments if someone from a lower caste tried to read the Vedas because they didn't want to lose their monopoly. And so they've created this inscrutable meta language in academics and philosophy that, you know, no one can understand except them. And in a sense, abandoning their responsibility to humanity. We take someone like Charles Dickens, for example. He was obviously a great writer. I mean, I don't think there'd be two opinions about that. Just, you know, one of the great writers ever. And yet he was wildly popular. So I may have gone to Harvard, you know, I can talk in inscrutable jargon, but like, what's the point of it? I'm not communicating. So,
I mean, this is why we all want to hear from you. Let me be really crystal clear. This is what this kind of sets the scene for, is helping us understand the two sides that you've spent so much time. I mean, you spent over five decades studying in terms of understanding, say, traditional aspects of world religions and philosophies and theologies around the world, as well as modern academic jargon in such a way. And correct me if I'm mistaken, but one of your things I've perceived to be excellent at is translating both of those into very accessible ways through the lens of logic and understanding. And I mean, I'm really curious, based off of everything you shared too, we're talking about rights, but as a cheeky way of saying it, we have rights and wrongs. Like, what if we're talking about what's quote unquote wrong with the world, or specifically, like, what is at the root suffering?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what the real problem is.
Yeah.
First of all, let's talk about monotheism, because if you don't come to monotheism, I think you're just not really being philosophically serious.
Yeah, trying.
Because you say, if there are many gods, there's no God, and where do things come from? We still don't know. That's why even, let's say, in ancient Greece, you had Homer with all his gods and goddesses, and Plato in the Republic, he says something which was extremely revolutionary at the time. He said, we shouldn't teach our children Homer, because if there's really a God, it's not these silly people like these adolescent, you know, Zeus and Hera, and like, you know, Hera or Zeus will say, like in the great battle at Troy, you see that Trojan there, I'm just gonna kill him. Well, why, Zeus? I don't like him. It's like, it's not, you know, the gods are like teenagers.
Yeah.
And well, actually, teenagers don't usually kill people, but
it's
so
like
sorry
prepubescent
about that.
Hormonal,
yeah,
children,
yeah,
of sorts. Yeah.
So, if you look at all the monotheisms in the world, there are basically two kinds: tribal monotheism, my God can beat up your God, we have the true God, you have a false God, which is, I think, philosophically just childish. And then there's philosophical monotheism. In the Greco-Roman world, despite all their gods and goddesses, no one, let's say the philosophers or the scholars, educated people, they didn't take that seriously as an explanation of what ultimately is true. And so there were many monotheists in the Greco-Roman world, Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, there's many of them. And they didn't fight religious wars. People who are philosophically monotheists don't fight wars. Even the Romans, who were, you know, so militaristic. I mean, the Romans, their own sort of creation story was they were born when the god of war begot the first Romans in a she-wolf, very macho. And
Sounds good.
Yeah, but they didn't fight religious wars. They fought for, you know, these sort of secular reasons, greed, power, and so on. But they didn't fight religious wars. In fact, Alexander the Great saw what he thought he was doing, apart from, you know, brutalizing anyone that didn't surrender to him. He surrendered.
Very nice.
Yeah. So he actually was a religious syncretist. It was a common understanding in the Greek civilization, the Greek world, of course, he was Macedonian, that there's one ultimately divine power. We call it by different names. They're very explicit about this. That is called the Interpretatio Graeca, the Greek interpretation. We use different names, but we're all worshiping the same God ultimately. And so therefore, we can have world culture. And then you have these Middle Eastern religions coming in where, no, you know, my God is the only true God and you're worshiping a false God. And it really poisoned. I think that this idea poisoned the Western world, because the idea that if you have a different religion than me, or simply you belong to a different denomination than me, let's say of Christianity, that you're not only, let's say, in my view, say theologically somewhat inaccurate, or some of the things you say are true, but I think you got some things a little off. But basically, worshiping the same God. No, that in the introduction of absolute evil, the introduction of absolute evil, a concept which doesn't exist in many old cultures, the devil and anyone that belongs to a different church or religion is actually the agent of absolute evil, of the devil. And therefore, it's like, I mean, take like the original mass shooting at the high school, Columbine High. Remember that, you know, horrible thing? And so when the SWAT teams came in and they had to take down the shooter, you could say, well, no, he's just a kid, you know. Yeah, he's a mass killer. You have to take him down. And so if you really believe, see, that's where you get totalitarianism. Totalitarianism actually, in my view as a historian, came from the introduction of this idea of an absolute evil, the devil, and everyone that doesn't exactly agree with my religion is actually representing the devil. And so therefore, like Columbine High, so if you actually believe that God is, in a sense, the most evil being ever imagined, that he will torture forever, like for billions of years.
For a thought crime.
Torture, yeah, his own children for a thought crime, then it's your duty, like, to take down any false preacher, if you really believe that. So that's where you get totalitarianism. Totalitarianism means the government not only is going to tell you what you can do, it can't do, what you can think. What you can think, and, you know, you can't have wrong thoughts. And then it spreads to the secular atheists with the French Revolution. And that's where, you know, in fact, terrorism, the word terrorism, is attributed to one of the architects of the French Revolution, Robespierre, because he thought that, and the reason is he was so religious. He wasn't Christian, but he had gone to a Christian school, and he was so much into everyone has to be morally pure. It's almost like Dr. Strangelove, the crazy general, purity of essence. You know, everyone has to be so pure. And he saw the peasants, or just people in general, they didn't get the memo. They were still kind of enjoying themselves. So therefore, he explicitly said, we have to terrorize them. So he introduced the idea of terrorism because their thinking wasn't correct. You actually have to, and of course, you know, we have to control what people think. And that goes back, of course, to the introduction of the devil, the absolute evil. But then, dialectically, Plato says that every political extreme produces its equal and opposite extreme. So tyranny produces anarchy and vice versa. And then you get, I mean, it's a very simple principle. You get Galileo, who was fascinated by pendulums. And so it's what's called the pendulum effect. And then Newton states it as a third law of motion. Every force in the universe produces an equal and opposite force. And then the philosopher Hegel took that and applied it to human history, the dialectic, thesis and antithesis. And so whether it's, you know, all these thinkers and many more that I haven't mentioned, whether it's Plato or Galileo or Newton or Hegel, it's the simple fact of the pendulum effect. So when history goes to this evil extreme, of the devil. And everyone that doesn't belong to my church is absolutely evil or is serving absolute evil and therefore must be destroyed. And not only just killed, I mean, that's, but they have to be killed in such a horrible way that people understand. And they actually have scholars at European universities studying the most horrible, painful ways to kill someone slowly so they didn't die too soon but could still suffer, you know, unimaginably. And so then you get the equal and opposite, and then you start to get the anti-religious genocides. You get the French Revolution, where killing all the priests. You get the Bolshevik Revolution, killing all the priests, and then Stalin, killing tens of millions of people. You get Hitler, who, by the way, was a neo-Darwinist, which they don't tell you in school. Yeah. Survival of the fittest, stuff that, you know, the Teutonic Germanic people. Yeah, they don't hit. Darwin's cousin is the guy that invented eugenics or invented the name eugenics, which is taking natural selection, which is brutal and savage in the natural world. On YouTube, you see lots of nature films, and you apply it to human society because Darwin's talking about, you know, finches and all kinds of little, you know, cute little creatures in the Galapagos Islands. But what happens when you take survival, this brutal, savage, murderous process called survival of the fittest, and apply it to humans? And so then the Nazis, they thought it's a great idea. They were eugenicists. They don't tell you that. So the greatest genocides in recorded history were done in the 20th century in the name of atheism and science. And so you have the introduction of this terrible doctrine. Everyone, even if someone's a good person, you know, helps old ladies across the street and charitable, just a nice person. But if they belong to the wrong church, they are representing the devil, absolute evil. And then when Christianity collapses as a convincing story for intellectuals in Europe, then you get the equal and opposite evil. And you start to get, you know, you get the Nazis, you get the Bolshevists, you get in Cambodia. I mean, in Cambodia, they murdered, it would be like in America if they killed, let's say, around 35 million people. I mean, think of that. The so-called revolution where they actually murdered maybe 33, don't want to exaggerate here, maybe 33 million people they just murder. That's what happened in Cambodia, especially anyone that had over a high school education. So you get these genocides starting with a religion where, we could talk about, what was his name? The Roman emperor, Theodosius, I think. Because the early Christians, as soon as they got power, they started killing them. I mean, they started destroying synagogues and destroying, pagan temples, Greek, Greco-Roman temples, and just, you know, physically attacking people. And so the emperor, Theodosius, said that you can't do that. You may not agree with them, but, you know, they're citizens. So then the bishop, I think it was Jerome, the bishop of Milan, he was definitely Bishop of Milan, threatened the emperor that if you don't allow the Christians to destroy synagogues and temples and just, you know, and just do all kinds of terrible things to pagans and Christians, then you will go to hell. So he had to stand down because, I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, according to historians, the Roman persecution of Christians was generally only done in one city, Rome, and it was sporadic. Whereas once the Christians got power, their persecution of everyone else was everywhere all the time. And so in the meantime, you get this very powerful spiritual tradition coming from India, from South Asia. The way I put it is, if all you knew about religion on Earth, you were an anthropologist from some other planet, and all you knew about religion on Earth was, let's say, the religions that came from India, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on, would you still say religion caused most of the wars? Actually, you wouldn't. So there is a great Indo-European understanding, which is tolerant, which is philosophical. And ultimately, I believe it culminates in what is called Vaishnavism, which is what we're presenting. So if you look at history, if you look at philosophy, you look at all kinds of things, it's not just sort of a fanatical claim. My God can beat up your God. It's a philosophical claim. The Just one last thing.
Can you explain? Well, yeah. At some point, I do want to, for those unfamiliar, yeah. Vaishnavism and Bhakti yoga.
Yeah, Vaishnavism means tradition based on Vishnu. Vishnu is a name for Krishna. It's kind of Krishna when he's at the office, you know, kind of with a suit and tie. And, you know, Krishna is more spontaneous, childlike, and so on. But so what you find going back to the oldest books, actually, in any language, like the Rig Veda, is a, and especially as the tradition develops, Rig Veda is more ritualistic, but you find a very powerful philosophical monotheism. And therefore in India, I mean, any normal, decent person in India will say, of course, Jesus is also a representative of God. You know, of course, the other religions are really worshiping God. It's not even an issue. It's not
inclusivistic, naturally.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. In other words, it's very, and if you look at Greco-Roman religion, it's very much going down to many little details, what I call Mediterranean Hinduism. If you look at the languages, if you look at ancient Greek, for example, what is called, now I get to show off, morphology, linguistic morphology. I hope you don't understand that, because then I could, you know, make me feel good. So it just means the structure of language. It's like startling. So, I mean, it's obvious. There aren't two opinions about this among scholars, that ancient Greek and ancient Latin and so on are intimately part of the same language family as Sanskrit. So in this Greco-Roman world, Greco-Roman Indic world, let's say, you have tolerance, you have the assumption that there's one God worshipped in different ways by different people. And in India, because for three reasons, I taught this at the University of Florida. I was teaching history of Indian religion. So India, I think, is the best place in the world to study world religions, at least the interaction of them. Because number one, may surprise you as a reason, but India, if you look at a map, a river map of India, is the best natural irrigation system in the world. There are rivers everywhere. And in the pre-industrial world, that was the basis of wealth. And India also has every conceivable climate, from the Arctic regions of the Himalayas down to the steamy, you know, tropical jungles and, you know, Kerala, whatever. And so it has every climate. It has, there are just rivers everywhere. And therefore it was, and plus it was very richly endowed with precious stones, I mean, gold. So India, up until the colonial rape of India, actually had a significant percentage, 20-30% of all the wealth in the world. It was by far the richest country in the world. And so therefore it supported a very large population. When you have weather that's livable and you have water everywhere so you can grow your own food, and it was a tolerant country, and so it always had, compared to other countries, a large population. And it was always religiously inclined. And the third thing is they always had religious freedom. Going back to the earliest books of Rig Veda, it says, you know, there's one God, but people invoke it with different names. So you have religious freedom, you have religious inclination of the people, and you have wealth, which means leisure. So they have the time, they have the political right to do it, and they have their own inclination. And so if you look at India, it's said to be the only country on earth where Jews were never persecuted. So in this, pardon this crass capitalist metaphor, in the open marketplace of religious ideas, the big winner was Krishna.
Well, explain more about that, because this is one thing, obviously I'm biased a little bit, because I've also, I took the roundabout way to come into Vaishnavism. Yes, Vita Coco. If you put in our promo code, no, we don't actually. Vita Coco, if you're watching though, we'll take your sponsorship. No, I took the scenic route trying different aspects of different philosophies, theologies, et cetera. But you've spent decades dedicating to exploring all different types of world religions, philosophies, and theologies. And so you're talking about how Vaishnavism, or maybe for those unfamiliar with the term, Bhakti Yoga, might have heard the term Krishna consciousness, et cetera. Why in your analysis and study would you consider this, say, the option that's made the most sense for you?
Okay. It's intrinsically rational. That's what I should explain that. I would say unpack, except it's not a suitcase. So, interestingly, Rupa Goswami, one of the great teachers in our tradition, one time when I gave a lecture at Harvard, actually before I was even a student there, they invited me to just lecture and all this stuff. And I was, the chairman at that time was a gentleman named Gary Tubb. He was chairman of the Harvard Sanskrit and Indian Studies program. Really, really nice guy. He was a very, very nice guy, gentleman. So he invited me into his office. We were just talking. And I remember he was just glorifying Rupa Goswami, saying he was, you know, this intellectual giant. Interestingly, Rupa, about 500 years ago, roughly, maybe 470 years ago, gave an argument similar to Anselm's so-called proof for the existence of God. You know, Anselm, he gave the argument that God is that being than whom no greater being can be conceived, and therefore a God that exists is greater than a God that doesn't exist. I mean, for 1,000 years, it struck people, or almost 1,000 years, kind of like a trick argument. But it's kind of like one of those things that it's a trick, but they can't figure out how to refute the trick. Yeah, so, but in any case, if God, let's say, just to sort of lay out the argument, if God is infinitely great, and therefore the greatest idea of God is the most accurate, the closest to the truth, and a God that exists is greater than a God that doesn't exist. But then I would say to Anselm, if we could bring him in, I don't know how much time we have left, but of course.
Phone a friend.
That I would say to Anselm that I can very easily imagine a God or a concept, let's say, of God greater than the concept of a God who, in the most horrible ways, tortures his own children forever for sometimes somewhat subtle theological errors. And so Krishna, and Rupa gives this argument in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, because he was operating that Indic world. He really, you know, I don't think he had any contact with Europe at the time, or at least never mentions it. And so he's talking about that Indic world, South Asian world, where there's Krishna, there's Vishnu, there's Shiva, there's Devi, the goddess, all these different candidates. And he argues that Krishna has the greatest number and type of qualities, and therefore implicit in Rupa's argument, which you find in the, you know, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, is that the greatest conception of God is the truest, because God is infinitely great. And so Anselm and Rupa, separated by just a couple centuries, are giving sort of the same type of argument. And so I think it's not like a logical proof, but you clearly have to make the initial assumption that if you make the initial assumption that God is infinitely great, then the greatest conception must be closest to the truth. And so I would argue on those grounds that the conception of Krishna is the greatest conception of God. And that's a whole discussion. What aspects? For example, the idea of a God who's infinitely beautiful. I've never heard Jehovah described as sort of drop-dead good-looking. But Krishna is. And so, again, I'm not against, by the way, Jehovah, that's not a name of God. It's actually Yahweh, but the Germans pronounced a Y like it. Anyway, it's a whole other story. I mean, Jehovah's not actually a name in the Bible. It was a mispronunciation of a German spelling. So it's not that, I'm not saying the God of the Old and New Testament is a false God. I'm saying, yes, that's God. That's the real God. But if you look at the attributes, like how is that God described? I think the descriptions that we find in Vaishnav Sanskrit literature, even the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is in sort of Sanskritic Bengali, it just describes, I think it's a more complete concept, which is more consistent with the notion of God being infinitely great. And so it's not, this is God, you're not worshiping God. No, it's the opposite. Yes, you are worshiping God. There's only one God. But this description, I think, reveals to us certain aspects and beauties and amazing things about God, information that's not simply available elsewhere.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, and again, for those maybe not as familiar, so this idea that there's one sun in the sky, no matter what name you call it, we're talking about the same sun, there's one God. And the reason that not only coming from the most ancient philosophies in the world, like you mentioned, the Rig Veda, oldest written literatures of the world. But logically and philosophically, it explains concepts of God and God's attributes in such a specific way so that it's perfectly synergetic with other descriptions of God, but far more specific and detailed, so yes, as to give us the most
but that's important
whole understanding.
Yeah, because if you, and it's not just scripture, it's interpretation. For example, Jesus never taught that anyone who doesn't belong to our institution, which there was no institution then. And actually, scholars agree, this is a consensus among academic scholars of Christianity, especially early Christianity, that neither Jesus nor even Paul believed they were starting a new religion. They were trying to reform Judaism. The new religion idea came later. Yeah. So, but I guess you could say, well, why is this even important? Is it just academic? It's interesting because the word academic has come to mean not really relevant, but like, well, it's academic now. Like, okay, let's say it's the NBA finals and there's only 10 seconds left and this team is behind 20 points. And so one of their players takes a shot. It's just academic, you know, in the sense it has no effect on the real world. Yeah. I mean, the very fact the word academic has come to mean that. So the reason you can say, why even is this just academic, just talking about comparative theologies or world religions? No, because at the present time in America, the reason the country is so divided, dangerously divided, and discourse has become so brutal and violent, we even have a president that just, if anyone disagrees with him, you know, he wants to sue them. And so, because there's no point of unity. There's no point. Freedom is good. I mean, as souls, we are by nature free, but you can cross a line where, like, what about the freedom of someone to kill another person? I mean, because freedom in a technical sense just means that you have the means and the will to do something, and there's no impediment. There's nothing that's going to stop you from doing it. So you're free to do it, but you can be free to do all kinds of evil. And so you can't sustain a civilized society without the sacred. And if you try to make the sacred, you know, the color of people's skin, it just doesn't work. It reminds me of this poem by W.B. Yeats, my favorite poet of the 20th century. And what is the Second Coming? Maybe, I can't remember which poem it is, but it starts out, turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. So if society doesn't have, it's like the solar system. It's only a system because of the solar part, because of the sun. You take the sun away, it's not a system anymore. And all the planets just go flying off to their destruction. So what's the center of our society? And you have to put something in the center. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. It's almost like a physical thing. If you put Jupiter where the sun is, that's the end of the system. You know, maybe Mercury will still, if it's, you know, maybe, you know, retain Mercury or something, that's about it. So what's the center of our society? What's the sacred center which holds the system together? You can't just invent something because it doesn't have the cultural or the intellectual or just the human power. It doesn't hold the system. So according to the Declaration of Independence, the center is the creator. And so if you kill that, if you take that away, the system collapses. And so basically what we're seeing in America now is a system which, because of, I would say, a fanatical degree of secularization rather than a wise and historically informed degree of secularization, what do you put in the center? What is the center, for example, of America right now? What is the center? I have my rights. No, I have my rights. Just people fighting and quibbling about, you know, my right is more important than your. And so there's no center.
Well, one thing I want to ask, and especially before we start to wrap this up, and this has been such an illuminating conversation, hopefully the first of many. Let's see, I'll twist your arm. But
make an offer I can't.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Kind of, you've given us so much to think about and so much direction to take. And, you know, we'll be providing so many resources on how people can learn more about these topics from you and from some of your literature, some of your books. One thing we always like to close this off with, which would take talking about all these concepts, which are many of which practical. If we were to distill a handful of practices or tools, behaviors that you would advise for somebody who is moving this direction, trying to live a more, as you might say, conscious lifestyle of sorts, what are some of those practical steps, tools, behaviors, right, et cetera, that would be helpful?
Yeah, it's because Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, I explained this whole section on this in my book, The Gita Guide. He frequently equates knowing with seeing. It's interesting because in the, let's say, Judeo-Christian tradition, there are some sort of outstanding philosophers who are defending, in general, theism through technical philosophy. And, you know, they're very bright, and I think they have good intentions. But what's interesting is, and I'm getting to your question, getting to the practice, that in my own opinion, just speaking now about philosophy as a discipline, when they're defending the general notion of theism, I think they make powerful arguments. When they're trying to defend a particular religion, I think their arguments get much weaker philosophically, just in terms of the logic. And one thing I've noticed, when these philosophers talk or try to give philosophical justification for belief in God, for acceptance of certain sacred traditions, it's always based on faith. This is why you should have faith. This is what, you know, and why, this is why faith would be a rational option for you. Whereas, and it struck me, because not coming myself from a Christian tradition, because in the Krishna conscious tradition, it's always about realization. We talk about realization. And Krishna in the Gita says you should learn from people who are tattvadarshis. You should learn from people who have seen the truth categorically. And so I was comparing and contrasting a tradition which always talks about faith and a tradition which always talks about realization, like in bhakti yoga, coming to higher states of consciousness where you see all these things and you see the truth, which Krishna talks about all the time, this knowledge means, real knowledge means seeing. And so the practice, a real practice, should not only strengthen your faith, but should bring you to higher states of consciousness where you see the truth. And therefore, it is self-validating. I'm not getting into this now, but Aristotle, the father of Western logic, makes this point. He accepted God not because he was just a very religious guy, which kind of wasn't, but it was the logical requirement. There must be an unmoved mover. There must be an original cause that explains why anything exists. And so, again, in India, where you had all the different traditions competing, you had Christian missionaries, you certainly had a very powerful, going back in time, not so much now, but a Buddhist missionary, because Buddhism started in India. You had Jainism. You had all the religions were there. And Krishna was the big winner, not because they killed everyone that didn't agree, as you see in other parts of the world. But it just struck people as the kind of the, you know, it flew off the shelf. It was just the best product in sort of the, you know, the ancient South Asian big box store of theologies. And so I think the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, Bhagavad Gita, is ultimately most comprehensive, sophisticated, and persuasive. And what Krishna is offering us in the Bhagavad Gita is direct realization, pratyakshavagamam, which literally means understanding by direct perception. You directly perceive the truth. Krishna also says, parangrishtva nivartate. It's often translated in the Hare Krishna universe as you need a higher taste. Actually, what Krishna literally says is that seeing something higher. So what, in a sense, if I can, you know, put on my preacher man cap here, what we're actually inviting people to do is to have an experience, Of course, this sounds very much like my time at Berkeley in the late 60s, you know, without LSD. But it's so the invitation, in a sense, Krishna's invitation is to come to a higher state of consciousness by this disciplined spiritual practice, which in Sanskrit is called yoga. I mean, yoga means many, many, many things, but ultimately it means a disciplined spiritual practice, and to see the truth. Become a tattvadarshi, a seer of categorical truth. And I think the fact that that's available to any reasonably sincere person who sticks to the practice, like if you want to become good at playing the piano or good at soccer or good at anything, you practice. If you don't practice, you're not really that serious about achieving a skill level. And so someone who wants to achieve that skill level in life, in knowing God, in knowing themselves as an eternal soul, there is a scientific practice which for thousands of years has attracted and persuaded and enlightened millions and millions and millions of intelligent people.
I mean, I don't want you to stop. Do you have about five more hours where we could
have
keep
you got
going
more coconut
this?
Water?
Well, let me say this. I think this is a beautiful step in what will be hopefully some other discussions with it. I mean, there's talk about Param Drishtva, which gets translated as higher taste. Hopefully everyone gets a little taste of sorts in what's available in just the vast understanding that you have, but
actually,
in these practices.
Actually, we should have some of the book chairs to show people.
Well, and that's the thing is in the show notes below for everyone. I mean, please, you guys know I will never promote something that I'm not actually interested in. My humble request is please go to the show notes and check out these books, especially Comprehensive Guide to the Bhagavad Gita, which I literally just, in case you guys are wondering, do I like this book? I purchased cases and I give them as gifts to people. I share them, put them in little packages. Pretty much all my clients have to get this book. Like seriously, that's how I read this book more times than anything. I read the Bhagavad Gita every single day, primarily as it is, but this is the runner-up. And it's changed my life. It's helped me understand the Gita, what to speak of your other resources and literatures. So not only do I want to take this opportunity to thank you for taking your precious time to come here and share your wisdom, at least give us a little taste to start moving that direction, but I really urge everyone listening to check out these literatures and these resources, because not only has it personally changed my life and created so much understanding, so much clarity, but I feel so certain beyond a doubt that if you consume what Acharya Dev has to offer, just representing this perfect lineage in such a perfect way, you too will not only get more clarity, more in touch with your own purpose, but frankly, just relief in life. And that's what I humbly request you all to check out. Thank you again, Acharya Dev, for your time.
My pleasure.
Really, really grateful to do this at least only 10 more times and we'll call it perhaps. Anyway,
thank you.